watched The Irishman
Let's start with that.
We watched The Irishman not long after recording last week's episode on The Shape of Water.
The Shape of Parmigiano.
I'm not sure what to say to that. No, we watched The Irishman. What did you guys think of The Irishman?
LOVEDIT. That shit was banging.
Yeah. It's probably going to be a while until I watch it again because of the length, but I think I really enjoyed how they didn't really explore the details of just like the underground crime ring itself, but they gave you like these little notes on who these people were and how they died, what their history was, why they were involved within this particular crime ring, and I thought that was really cool. I also really liked without trying to give away too much for those who haven't seen it. There's this one scene in particular where it's at the very start where the Irishman is going through like his process of how he takes jobs, and there's this one character in particular who like comes up to him at a restaurant, and Robert De Niro is breaking down like why he's coming up to him, and it like that particular scene sets up pretty much the entire mood with Jimmy Hoffa, where you see this man who's pretty much at the top of the world turn into like this desperate like criminal who's just trying to escape his own mistakes, and then having to deal with the crime ring and like being exiled and all that stuff. I thought it was really cool. It was very like circular.
I think it was maybe the most Martin Scorsese movie I've ever seen.
I would agree with. I was thinking about how I enjoy this. This feels like Goodfellas grew up. And I think I see that only as a good thing, because like, I'm not the biggest fan of Goodfellas.
I am.
I much prefer... actually, I watched this at 2 in the morning last night. Just because I saw it first, and it's a Goodfellas ripoff, but because I saw this first, Ted Demme's 2001 film Blow, starring Johnny Depp,
about the introduction of
cocaine. And I get Goodfellas is probably a better movie. I think this is the grown-up Goodfellas. I think I like it more. And what I noticed about this is that unlike any other Scorsese movie, at no point in this is there any like romanticism of the mob life.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, at no point do you think, oh, I want to... It would be cool to be one of these characters. Like, it'd be cool
it's,
to be...
Yeah, it's not the Henry same Hill. As...
The way that the story was kind of laid out for us, it was structured in a very documentary film style, where they were interviewing the Irishman at what was, like, a retirement home.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just kind of taking us through this history of like, organized violence, or organized crime, and the violence that that surrounds it. And it was just really interesting to see how, like, you know, the parallels between like what's going on now within the news and how like the, you know, we have a president that's kind of surrounding himself with, there's one character in particular, can't remember his name, but he's played by Joe Pesci.
Russell Bufalino?
Yeah,
Russell Bufalino.
Yeah, where he, a lot of the things that he was organizing was done through third parties. It was never really a direct statement coming from him,
right?
Mm-hmm. And that just drew parallels to like the whole impeachment inquiry that's going on right now, and how like,
mm-hmm.
you know, a lot of Republican Congress members are like, oh, we need definitive proof that Trump said these things, and it's the same thing where it's like, we need definitive proof that Joe Pesci is like
orchestrating.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys had this thought or if this was just me. I think Martin Scorsese's pride was the only thing stopping this from being a miniseries. As a whole of a film...
You're probably right.
As a whole of a film, I'm not going to say that it was bad that it was as long as it was. I think that the structure, like the individual scene structure itself and like the sequences, I think it really could have worked well as a miniseries. I think it didn't have to be 3.5 hours. There are certain films that I think have to be 3.5 hours, but this felt like it was several individual stories within one overarching narrative about, and like his sort of small involvement in this. I think it would have been a really just quality miniseries, mm-hmm. maybe like 3 episodes, the length of a Chernobyl episode.
Yeah, I mean, but, you could have even added more. And,
yeah, I would have liked to see more.
You know, made like, it a 4 or 5 episode miniseries, you know?
Mm-hmm. I really would have liked to see more of this.
I also think you could have cut it down to a, you know, I couldn't give you the exact length that it would be, but I think you could cut it down to a shorter film if you just do all the Hoffa stuff. If you just stuck to only the Jimmy Hoffa narrative.
Yeah.
I think you could cut it down to a smaller film.
Yeah, but that was
I don't think it would work as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you're right. Like, it could have been cut down to a film. There's no point, though, and that's the thing, is, like, there's no part in it where I was, like, there wasn't any individual scene that didn't feel like it was blowing my mind the same way that Chernobyl did this year, where, like, it worked as a miniseries. Like, it could have been a movie, but there was no sequence. They could have made a Chernobyl movie. It could have had the same quality, same characters, same style, but there was no individual sequence in Chernobyl mm-hmm. that wasn't mind-blowing to me, to the point where I would have been like, yeah, they could have done without this part or without this episode. But yeah, I really do think Martin Scorsese's pride is probably what kept that from being a miniseries.
Just caught a body.
He did catch a body. That was some wax on, wax off shit.
Yeah. I've gotten really good at killing fruit flies.
You should watch the documentary I Like Killing Flies, which is on our
shelf. Yeah, it's on our shelf right there. I've looked at it. I've thought about watching it. It's the only documentary that we own,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Favorite performance of the 3 principal leads, and then favorite performance of a...
Hoffa.
Really?
Yeah.
I gotta go Bufalino.
I really enjoyed Hoffa in this, and like that's not to take away anything from like De Niro or
I know
the rest of the crew, but I think there is just something about like his character and the way that he like portrayed this like guy who is clearly just losing
all in on his own ego.
Yeah, like he was losing grip on his own sense of reality, and like it's just the way that he had kind of played that role was just phenomenal to me. I really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. That's actually funny that's what you guys said, because mine definitely was De Niro in this movie.
Oh, but mine's Pesci, so.
Yeah. Well, what I thought was really interesting about this particular movie is, you know, for a while, because it's, what, an hour 20 before Pacino comes in?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
It's a while. So I'm thinking, I'm watching this, is a very different, like, even though it's the same type of movie that they make, this is a very different character that Robert De Niro is playing. Like,
Very different character that Pesci's playing.
Pesci is really reserved. De Niro is, he's not too bright, but there's only a couple scenes where his rage is apparent. It's like he very much... You know from the beginning that you're not paying attention to a character that is in charge of what's going on. Like, he is a lackey. He is very... And that's not something that I feel like I see from him a lot.
No. I mean, look at him in the other 2 Scorsese mob movies he's mm-hmm. made. In Casino, he fucking runs the casino.
Yeah.
And in Goodfellas, he's like...
It's interesting that you say that, though, because, like... Because he was still, like... For him being a lackey, he was still very much feared as a character throughout the film.
But he wasn't, he didn't have the power.
Right.
And he knew he that and kind didn't. Of succumbed to that.
Yeah, he accepted that.
So yeah, De Niro, Pesci, very different type of characters. This was like the most Pacino thing I've seen Pacino do in a long time.
But yeah, like, it was like devil's advocate level Pacino.
It really was. It was all yelling.
It was good.
I really liked, stylistically, there was a lot going on in this movie, but I kind of liked it. There was some framing in this movie that almost felt I guess you say this every time. It's like, oh, look how symmetrical this frame is. It's like Wes Anderson inspired, but like that and like the titles coming up. I don't know. I'm always so interested in talking about like how much Wes Anderson has impacted the independent movie scene. I was thinking about that a lot 2 weeks ago when I was watching Hunt for the Wilder People with my family.
That movie took a lot of inspiration from it, but yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you guys watch anything else this week?
Last night, Lars and I saw...
I do want to hear about
this. Yeah, we watched a very absurd, and I mean like absurd, dark comedy. It was called The Bar.
El Bar,
because it is a Spanish film.
España.
And it just like, from the first 5 minutes, the impression that you get is that this is going to... It's going to be a very, like, normal film. It's going to center around this woman and, like, her...
She's going to go on a date.
She's meeting someone up on a date, and it appears to be this guy that is just, you know, the average dude. So, the movie, like, after the 10-minute marker just...
You paused it right when the inciting incident happened, and you were like, "Oh, 9 minutes and 35 seconds." And I was like, "Holy shit!"
9 minutes and 35 seconds into this film, it's 2 hours long, and it like, whew, it's something that I had to rewatch twice. Like I had watched it once before Lars came over. I rewatched it when Lars came over because I was like, "There's so many details to this movie that like set up what you're getting yourself into that I just." Either wasn't really paying any mind to or just completely flew over my head. And
you can know the premise of it. A group of strangers get trapped inside a bar in downtown Madrid after somebody is killed on the street. The opening chunk, you know, there's a lot of like, why was this person killed? Should we stay in the bar? Should we go outside? You know,
it
starts kind of like mass shootery. They're all like, oh, we gotta just wait until the cops kill this guy or he kills himself. Okay.
It's very much like everything is very much reactionary. Like everything that happens to them leads to one thing. And then like
cause and effect.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So highly recommend.
Absolutely.
What was it called?
The Bar.
It's on Netflix.
El Bar.
It's on Netflix. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. I don't think I watched anything this week outside of watching Blow last night, which just,
It's a fine movie.
Everything about it is Scorsese.
Some Hayek, right?
No, Penelope Cruz. It's Johnny Depp, Penelope Cruz. Ray Liotta is in it. Ray Liotta plays Johnny Depp's dad, which does not track for me because they had to have been relatively close to the same age at this point.
I wish Ray Liotta would play my dad.
Yeah, so I don't think I watched anything outside of Blow. I was honestly thinking about this, though. Like, is there anything that actually makes this movie stand out other than a very quality performance from Pee Wee Herman? Like, he's probably my favorite character in the movie.
But there is like a really funny tweet that I've been sitting on for a while that I might have from at Gloomfather. My main issue with The Irishman is that it centered the experience of a relatively narrow demographic to the exclusion of many identities we've come to expect to see represented in modern film. There was no talking of Raccoon Man, no Tree Man, no Robert Downey Jr., the Hulk.
That's funny.
That's pretty good.
I'm Sam. I'm currently drinking red wine out of a mason jar and trying to stay awake.
Oh, I'm Lars. I'm drinking red wine out of a coffee mug. I'm also trying to stay awake.
I'm Juan. I'm also drinking red wine out of a mason jar. And I've been awake since like 7 in the morning, but I'm always trying to stay awake. I'm trying to be woke as I can.
Yeah. And we'll just get into it. We took a change of pace for this week. And Lars, what did we watch on Thursday night? By the way, this is the first time since doing this that I believe I have actually sat to watch a movie for like for this with either of you, because I sort of watched The Fly with you, but I was also working on this desk.
Right.
Anyway, what did we watch on Thursday?
We watched the 2008, I believe.
2008, 2007.
Yeah, we watched the old comedy movie Role Models, starring Paul Rudd and Sean William Scott, directed by David Wayne. Pretty simple little comedy film. Two co-workers and buddies get into a legal incident stemming from Paul Rudd's breakup, which causes him to go on a spiral, which ends up getting them in some legal trouble. And instead of going to prison, their only recourse is to do 150 hours of community service, specifically through a Big Brother program of sorts. They each get paired up with a problem child who needs some sort of adult role model in their life. Both children end up being crazy. One is played by Christopher Mintz-Plasse, either just before or just after McLovin. And then the, I can't think of the kid's name, but Tracy Jordan Jr. or the little kid from those Leapfrog commercials, they start hanging out with these kids for 150 hours over a month. And Paul Rudd and Sean William Scott are not good role models.
Though they try their best.
Though they try their best. And that's, you know, most of the comedy premise. Yeah, you know, it's a David Wayne comedy. It feels like something that if I didn't know that it was David Wayne, it's the sort of thing that I would think would be like a Judd Apatow comedy. It has a very loose improvisational feel during a lot of the scenes.
It involves Paul Rudd.
Like it does involve Judd Paul Apatow Rudd
comedy.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
I think that sums it up. It's there's not a ton going on. There's not much more to be said in terms of a synopsis, but yeah. Any general impressions? I mean, I have seen this movie a number of times. I have loved it for years. This is the first time I watched it in a long time, and for me, it certainly held up.
Yeah, I think for me, the last time I saw it was for its theatrical release.
Mm.
So having seen it with, you know, more than 10 years.
Oh, yes, we watched the unrated version.
Yeah, ooh, yeah. Having seen it.
I didn't see anything unrated.
No, there wasn't really anything to set it apart from its theatrical release. But, yeah, for me, it definitely still held up. I thought there was something that Sam brought up that was really interesting about how, like, for his first time seeing this movie, there was things that he was felt like he was laughing more at than we were on our second viewing, because it probably was like just something that, like a joke that we've already seen the setup for, so it was like something we've already expected.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you guys remembered this, but there were, I remember multiple moments where things, like a scene would begin and I would start laughing because I remembered what the gag was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, I forgot. Ah, and I started laughing before the joke even came.
Yeah, you know, I remember you doing that for one. And for some reason, the only joke that I knew before this movie, like the only joke that I knew going into it, and I guess I didn't realize that it was from, I knew the whispering eye joke, and you were laughing before that actually happened.
It's one of my favorite, it's my all-time favorite delivery from Christopher Mintz-Plasse in anything. It's like, ugh. It means vagina is just so good.
Mm-hmm.
Gets me every time. Because there's like, there's pride and there's embarrassment and there's disbelief. It's a fantastic little moment.
It's good. That was a good one. I will have to, I will say this, that like, you know, there were some quality performances in this movie. Having not seen it before, I laughed a lot. It was good. I enjoyed watching it. I don't even know if I can say. I was about to say this might be my favorite Jane Lynch character.
It is my favorite Jane Lynch character.
Then I remembered I own A Mighty Wind on DVD, and that actually is probably my favorite Jane Lynch character. But
you know what I used to have for breakfast?
Cocaine.
You know what I had for lunch?
Cocaine.
What'd you have for dinner?
Was it more cocaine?
There were some moments.
Knee slapper.
I used to be addicted to drugs. Now I'm addicted to helping.
This is, I think the most I'll say about it right now, because we're going to get into some more reasons why I enjoyed watching this. I definitely think I would have enjoyed it if I watched it when I was, I don't know how old you guys were when you first watched this.
High school.
High school, yeah. High school, middle school. Like, if I watched this closer to when it came out, I probably would have enjoyed it more, just because this was coming out at a similar time to movies like Superbad and The Hangover and all these kind of raunchy, like, guy buddy comedies. But yeah, you know, I enjoyed it. It was funny. It had some very quality performances in it.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, that's where the strongest suit.
Suit is like Paul Rudd, Jane Lynch, John Trujillo.
Yeah, he was his name.
Ken Jeong.
Ken Jeong is great.
Ken Jeong's great. Whoever it was that was playing that Martin character.
Oh, yeah. I don't know who that actor is, but Martin is my favorite character in the movie.
I enjoyed watching this movie, but I don't know if it's something that I will ever be reaching for off the shelf to watch again. I don't think it goes into my pantheon of comedic films that I say, oh, I need to watch this again. So I guess that is really, that was my question, is like, what exactly is it comedy specific that makes something rewatchable? Because I think it's harder. I wrote this down in my notes. I think it's harder for a comedy to age well than it is.
Oh, certainly.
Any other film.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing that, or at least one of the things that makes comedy specifically rewatchable, and this comedy in particular, is looking back on it and seeing comedians and other actors, but generally comedy talent, before they hit their, you know, moment of fame or their peak in a bit role. I mean, if you watch this movie, you see Keegan-Michael Key has one line in it. Mm-hmm. He's in the background of most of the film, but, you know, he's in the movie. Louis C.K. has two lines in the film. I mean, I could go on for a while with how many different people have little lines, little parts in it that ended up going on to do much better things throughout the 2010. Jorma Taccone's in it. Yep, Jorma Taccone, which is, you know, this is probably right around the time that Lonely Island was making a splash. I think Incredibad came out in 2008.
Yeah, I think this was around Incredibad time. Yeah.
But
Sandberg was on SNL at that point.
I think this was about a year before Hot Rod. I think Hot Rod was 09, but I'm not sure.
But outside of, like, the small, or like seeing people in small roles that, you know, are about to get huge, or, you know, looking back and going, holy shit, look at Jane Lynch in this, or whatever. I think that makes a comedy movie rewatchable. And I also think this one is rewatchable because of how many different little characters there are who might just appear for a scene or two, but every single little character that you run into is funny. You know? I have some tiny little guys. I mean, you've got David Wayne's character, who only shows up to not know how to play the acoustic guitar at the campground. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, Key only has one line in the film, and he just does it in the weirdest voice. Like, okay, y'all, we're going to make some chocolate s'mores, but we're going to use white chocolate.
Yeah, that was like a funny line.
Yeah.
And you're like, what? But I think the making use of every single one of your characters for a comedy point and having every single character be ridiculous really made the film rewatchable for me, because every time we'd like cut to a new character or somebody new would walk into the scene, I would remember, oh, this guy's gonna be funny. Oh, I remember this more so than, like, if it was just Paul Rudd and Sean William Scott going back and forth for 90 minutes, I would not feel the same way about rewatching it.
Okay.
You know? And I also think all the ridiculous characters make Paul Rudd's performance and character way more believable. Because outside of him and Elizabeth Banks, every single person in the film is like an unrealistic comedy character. Like somebody who does not exist in the world.
How much of that comes from that, like, nostalgia route of like, oh, I did enjoy that before, or and like how important is that to enjoying it now? Is because you did enjoy that before.
Well, I mean, I don't know how to quantify that or look inside my head, but I think regardless of if it was nostalgia or not, it was rewatchable. And nostalgia is pretty much the key thing to redoing anything, at least I would think, you know? That's why I can still watch the Star Wars prequels. It's nostalgia, you know? Like, it's why I can still watch most things I rewatch is nostalgia. I don't, you know, I would say nostalgia is pretty much the key, especially for something like a comedy, for me at least, because a lot of times, like when I watch Black Dynamite, which is my all-time favorite comedy.
Right. I was actually just
I rewatch that constantly. I mean, I know every joke. I could quote pretty much every one-liner in that movie. But when I'm watching them in the movie, I'm laughing not only with everybody in the room, but I'm laughing with myself every other time I've watched the movie. And that's kind of how I felt watching this. And that's why I would start laughing when you know, like the whispering eye scene came about, because I remembered enjoying it and then I enjoyed it again.
Okay.
So, I would say, yes, nostalgia factored in, but I don't think that's a bad thing.
Yeah, I don't think it's a bad thing. I think for me personally, nostalgia doesn't really work, like, as far as the aging process goes. Juan, I don't know if you were around for this. A couple months ago, we watched what was formerly one of my favorite comedy movies, in a very similar vein to this, like, as far as type of humor goes, but we watched Waiting, which
I was here for that.
You were here for Waiting?
Yeah. I remember that because Lars hadn't seen that movie.
Yeah, I hadn't seen it, and I think, did I buy it? Am I the one?
No, I own it. I own it. Okay. I got it at the Brown Elephant a couple years ago.
I mean, the whole reason we watched it was because I hadn't seen it, and I work in a bar.
Yeah, I was remember thinking, like, oh, Waiting is fucking hilarious, and, like, no matter how much I enjoyed it in high school, I don't know. There was something about it that just wasn't doing it for me anymore. Whereas something like...
Yeah, I mean, it didn't really do it for me during it. So I think a part of that's got to be age. But nostalgia probably impacts you less because...
Okay. One?
Yeah, well, if I could compare the two, like, Waiting definitely had some running jokes that just, like, as far as transcending decades go, like, there's some that just didn't blend well. Like, that whole running joke with in Waiting... with Ryan Reynolds' character, and he's hitting on the hostess of the bar.
Oh, yeah, who's like,
and it's like barely, 17.
Yep.
And I was just like, this joke like totally is not very, it's not appropriate for, you know, the decade that we're living in. But
and there's also a ton of the non-fuck F-word.
Yeah, yeah. Mm, so there's, for me, like, Waiting is definitely one of those movies that I'd watch purely for the nostalgia of, like, oh, I've worked in food industry before. I know what it's like to have to serve people like this. So to kind of be able to put myself in that mindset of, like, you know, fuck customers, fuck.
Yeah.
Fuck customers. I would say that the words that are used in Waiting and the culture that surrounds that is not off. I didn't really find it as funny.
I hear that shit.
Yeah.
Constantly.
And like, I'm not even saying like, you know, like there was just something about the gags that didn't really work.
It's not coming from me either. It's
it's coming from fucking everybody in the kitchen, yo.
Yeah. But yeah, so I guess that doesn't really work. And I mean, I had no nostalgia base for this movie either. Juan, what do you think is this something that, like, upon rewatching it for your second time, because I think you probably have seen this a lot more than Juan has?
I've seen it at least 4 times now.
Okay, and Juan, you told me this was the second time, right?
Yeah, and to my point, like, of it not being able to, like, Waiting not being able to transcend, like, the jokes being able to carry over into this decade, I thought there was a lot of jokes that, you know, could be picked up as, like, personal, like, running jokes in just ordinary life, you know, the whole what was it, whispering eye
the whispering eye.
Like, you know, that's something that, like, I could casually just bring up as a joke.
Yeah,
and like,
I was waiting for this movie to tell a joke that was like uncouth. Mm-hmm. You know, and it never really happened.
And yeah, I didn't understand the unrated
if it did happen, it was done in a very tasteful way, and most of those lines came from Sean William Scott.
Mm-hmm, which was more satirizing somebody who would say that.
Yeah.
Not the point of the joke being, haha, somebody's gay or something.
Right.
It's, which is why I really like Sean William Scott in this movie. I don't really, I don't like him in most things, but I think he does a pretty good job in this one. I guess it's not even him. I mean, I like him. I like what he does. I think that 9 out of 10 times Sean William Scott's in a movie, he is used and framed in the improper way. Because I think what Sean William Scott does is satirize a type of man,
like a
type of masculine ideal. Mm-hmm. And I think he's supposed to be the butt of the joke. But when you watch an American Pie movie, Stifler's like the cool badass guy. And then as the American Pie sequels go, they all still talk about Sean William Scott's character like he's the coolest guy ever. And, you know, that's not what I think is funny about Sean William Scott's stick.
And that's something I was explaining to Sam earlier today, too, about how, like, all the lines that were written for that character were specifically written with the, I think, with the idea that Sean William Scott was going to be cast as that character. Because it's almost as if, like...
Ooh, we could transition to your question.
Yeah, like, he was definitely, like... His character was almost a carbon copy of almost every other character he had played from, mm-hmm. like, the late 90s, early 2000s, like, raunchy comedies that you would get from, like, American Pie and Euro Trip and stuff like that. And so, like, to see him kind of revisit it and, I would say, like, kind of hone his craft as what he was, like,
well, this is, like, right before he did what I think is his best performance in Goon.
Yeah, like...
I have not seen Goon.
Oh, it's so good.
And that seems like something where you're actually getting a different kind of character from him.
No.
No?
No, he's the same. It's just it's just a more in-depth look at what that character's like.
Well, and
but it's the same guy. Always the same guy.
Right, and Juan and I were having this conversation earlier, and I guess, you know, we kind of get into what Juan's question was also, but I also feel like the way that my question stemmed out is also intrinsically tied to your question. And honestly say this is like we're trying to figure out how to do this to whoever actually is listening, and we're trying to figure out instead of us saying like, oh, we want to talk about these topics, the three of us have been like trying to choose a specific question. And Lars, your question was
what's more important, structure or gags?
Right. So my opinion about the Sean William Scott character is that there are so many, like, because the Paul Rudd character was the better written character.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Paul Rudd is the protagonist.
Yes, absolutely he is.
It's not...
And Juan and I were having this conversation on the walk back from Mariana's where he thinks the Paul Rudd character is the one where other people could have been cast for the part.
I completely agree. And I think agree Sean William Scott could... Nobody else could have done that.
See?
No. And I think that the fact while that Paul Rudd was fantastic, I think the movie could still work with somebody else in Paul Rudd's place.
I think it's more of a risk with that. I think there are people, because Sean William Scott's character was so, I'm not even just going to say one-dimensional, but his character arc was pretty cliche. His overgrown man-child.
Paul Rudd's character arc is pretty cliche.
I don't think I see the man learning how to get over his anhedonia and learning how to just enjoy life in this type of movie as often as the... one of the things, though, there were two things that I remember telling you on our walk back. One, it's like the overgrown man child has to learn some responsibility.
Right.
It's Sean William Scott's character is Mrs. Doubtfire, but without all of the the fun bells and whistles.
Yeah.
But like as far as that kind of frat boy character, I do think there's kind of a laundry list of actors at that time who especially were in that Sean, like pretty much immediately I said Ashton Kutcher could have played the Sean William Scott character. You don't think so?
No, I mean, part of it is I fucking hate Ashton Kutcher. I have never liked him in anything.
Oh, yeah, but I also feel the same way about, like, I don't... And, yeah, I'll just say it now. I didn't think Sean William Scott needed to be in this movie. I didn't think his character needed to be in this movie. I think this movie would have been much more interesting if it was just focused on Paul Rudd and, like, the LARPing.
Yeah, but I think
that was less predictable.
If Sean William Scott wasn't in this movie, then there's nothing that, like, Paul Rudd's just, like, an asshole.
Yeah.
And anytime, like, you cut to just Paul Rudd having to deal with it, it would just be a misery to watch. Just Paul Rudd by himself dealing with that. There's no fun. It's much better to have him have a dummy to bounce
the,
on.
The way I would describe it is, you're familiar with, like, the Garfield
the comics. Garfield comics? Yeah.
Garfield
yeah.
comics without Garfield, where it's just John being, like, super depressive and, like... Oh. That's what I would imagine, like, role models would be without Sheldon William Scott. It's just, yeah. like, this really depressive man going through these, like, episodes.
Yeah, but he had Christopher Mintz-Plasse as his foil to be more silly.
Yeah, and, but like, then that's the you connection. Wouldn't have Tracy Jr. in it.
Right, and I think... So, I think that the two separate movies that exist in here where there is the relationship between Paul Rudd and Christopher Mintz-Plasse and the movie between... Sean William Scott and Tracy Jr., you see a relationship between the bigs and the littles.
Yeah.
You don't really see a developing relationship between Paul Rudd and Sean William Scott. You know that Sean William Scott disagree. Loves... You know that Sean William Scott loves Paul Rudd. You know that Paul Rudd doesn't really care about him as much. At the end, Sean William Scott, he like calls him. He's like, no, you gotta please help me out. And he shows up and then he's like, yeah, you're my friend. Like, I didn't get a lot out of the development of that character relationship to the point where I thought that those were two stories that were totally separate and weren't really that entwined. Not that I disliked it. I just thought that Sean William Scott's was the more cliche.
Yeah, but I don't.
His was the most predictable.
It's
a comedy movie.
It's supposed to be cliche.
Right, and that's where I want to get into your question.
Mm-hmm.
So, your question about... gags versus structure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think one of them is more important than the other. I think you gotta commit to one.
Mm.
You need to either have, like, I think of the classic comedy movies that are, this is another thing Juan and I were talking about on the way back. I think of the classic comedy movies that are just gag after gag after gag after gag. And
Airplane.
Airplane, Black Dynamite.
Love Airplane.
Specifically, I was talking about Blazing Saddles.
Okay, yeah.
Oh. The plot of Blazing Saddles is the plot of 50% of the Westerns coming out right there, where it was new sheriff in town helping to, help, like, he has to, like, bring the townspeople together to fight against the bandit. The movies that are comedies that I think last, that aren't just gag after gag after gag, really... have strong structures. And the movie that I was talking to Juan about that he hasn't seen but I know you've seen was I Heart Huckabees,
mm-hmm.
which is one of my like favorites. We both watched that for the first time together, and that I wouldn't say is gag heavy, but it's a hilarious movie. I agree that it's okay for a comedy to be predictable, but I think it works like that and it feeds into the rewatchability, because I think what makes a comedy last longer is the ability to get something new out of it every time you watch. And with the gag-heavy movies, it's because there are so many jokes happening one after another that you can't catch them all at once, which is why...
Black Dynamite's endlessly rewatchable.
Why pretty much any Mel Brooks movie is endlessly rewatchable.
Good Zucker films.
Was gag after gag after gags in a way that I don't think Role Models has. Like, I don't think it's just... Like, it tries to make the plot feel important, but... I think there was a lot cliche about this plot, and not... It wasn't so gag-heavy that made it work for me. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I think the humor in this movie doesn't necessarily just come out of gags. I think there's a lot more character humor.
Okay.
You know? Like, a lot of the jokes are characters interacting off each other, bouncing back and forth. Christopher Mintz-Plasse is awkward. Whereas, like, if you watch Airplane, there are some jokes about, like, Leslie Nielsen's character and about... I can't think of...
Oh, yeah.
More of the jokes are, I have a drinking problem and he spills water on his face.
Plot's not important in those movies.
No.
The plot's not important in Black Dynamite. The plot's not important, like, in order to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
The plot's not important. Whereas I think the plot was important for enjoying this movie. And I'm saying it's not a bad thing. No, I'm not. It's more of like it was a very... I thought the plot... It felt kind of cliche to me. The plot did.
I would agree.
I think that comes with the archetypes though. Like there's when it comes to predictability with comedies, I think there's in terms of like storytelling, I think the archetypes will almost be able to tell the story for you. Where you had Sean William Scott's character who is very immature and very macho, trying to pick up chicks, like, frat guy throughout most of the movie. And then, like, you try to have him go through this real change throughout the film. And, like, you have these... this almost like, you know, this person's gonna have to eventually grow up in a mature way.
Yeah.
And like to have to see him go through those changes throughout the movie, like you're kind of expecting that he's gonna you know, succeed in some things and then he's gonna fail in like in other aspects. And I think for me, there's just certain ways that you can kind of make those archetypes like go through creative and mm-hmm. funny gags.
Yeah.
And I think that's where this film succeeded, at least with Sean William Scott's character.
And that, I guess, is just where I would have liked this movie so much better if it was all devoted to the Paul Rudd, Christopher Mintz-Plasse. Like Paul Rudd learning to have fun again. Because that was something that I felt was more unique. My favorite scenes were always the LARPing scenes.
The montage.
It's just there was so much about Sean William Scott playing the same Sean William Scott character. There was so much about how predictable his storyline was. I knew that his big like act two going into act three rift was, you know, he is finally grown an attachment with this kid with like serious abandonment issues, and so I knew it was going to be like, oh, he's going to ditch this kid for a woman and not talk to him. Like I guess that movie was sort of boring to me, and I wanted to see more of like the Paul Rudd, Christopher Mintz-Plasse stuff, and like that's where it was more of like it wasn't as many gags. All the good gags were with the LARPing and with John Turturro.
Yeah.
Let us single, now gingerly touch tips.
Everything, his delivery in that film is so good. Yeah, when I was in high school, he was my favorite part of
the,
it.
The delivery in this film in general, I think was just fantastic. I'd made a note about that, about how Paul Rudd's like his deadpan delivery for just like most of these things that people would try to get him excited for, and he'd just be like, nah.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Well,
so Juan.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that you had your question specifically geared towards, like, both of you don't see the Sean William Scott character as being as replaceable, but you do see the Paul Rudd, like, who...
I wouldn't say replaceable, where, like, I don't think it would be the same movie if you put somebody else in there. But I think it would stay closer to what it is if you swapped out Paul Rudd's character for somebody else, as opposed to Sean William Scott.
Right, I guess for me it's like Sean Williams, it's the better written characters I think are the harder ones for you to be able to see.
But I don't think different Paul Rudd's character is doing anything, like I think Paul Rudd does a fantastic job, but I don't think his character is doing anything that only Paul Rudd could do. I really feel like anybody could play that role.
Sam about how like with Sean William Scott's character, like it for me, it seemed like it was just him wrapping up what was a decade of an archetype that was played out through like most films in the early 2000s, mm-hmm. with like the American Pies and Eurotrip and other movies like that. Where like Paul Rudd's character towards the tail end of the
Scott and Eurotrip.
No, but you know, like
I just had the idea of somebody who I think could do
the Sean William Scott part
and probably even better.
Can I guess? Because I just thought of it too. Can we say it at the same time? Right. 1, 2, 3. Ryan Reynolds. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Holy shit. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Because I started thinking about Van Wilder.
That's
for some
exactly
reason.
What my head went to. Yeah. I was like, wait. Wait. If Ryan Reynolds was Wheeler, it would probably be a better movie. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
They could both be replaced.
Well. Okay. Okay. But like there are characters who like it isn't necessarily. Jeremy Irons was originally cast as Hannibal Lecter.
I can't even imagine what that
exactly
would be like.
Exactly. It's like one of those, because that character is so well written, and like a performer who is good goes into it, where like there are probably other actors that could have done just as iconic as a job, but like you can't really think about it. Whereas I think with a poorly written character, that's where the archetype starts to fit in, where you can start to think of an Ashton Kutcher or you can start to think of a Ryan Reynolds, mm-hmm. in a spot like that.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of guys that I could see doing the Paul Rudd part.
The one that I had brought up, and I think this fits well because towards the tail end of the decade in the 2000s, you started seeing more characters like show up like this in comedies. But like Bradley Cooper from The Hangover.
Okay,
Bradley Cooper could totally have played this part.
Bradley Cooper and Paul Rudd have a similar vibe.
Yeah.
I think Bradley Cooper's better at being like a...
more cynical.
I'm thinking about Wedding Crashers right now. I think Paul Rudd's a better asshole. Bradley Cooper's a better douchebag.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I would agree. This is a part that could have also worked for a douchebag.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would have changed some of it, but yeah, Bradley Cooper. I don't know. I mean, I do think the casting worked really well, though. Now I kind of want to see this movie with Ryan Reynolds answered.
What do you think is more important?
Well,
like, what would you rather watch, gags or like structure? Because there are movies. Again, it's so weird to think about. There are movies that
can I make a guess for Lars? If I know Lars, I think he'd love more gags just because of how, you know, just the. To answer that question of being able to rewatch a comedy, like the gags are really what make it. Like when I read, going back to the movie that we had watched this last night with the bar, like there was so many gags that, you know, like there, upon first viewing, like it totally just pass you over the head unless like someone who's already seen it will like subtly mentions it to you about how you should be watching out for this particular element in the movie.
Which was super nice to watch it with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, no, Juan's totally right. I prefer gags. I mean, if you look at my life, I'm clearly not great with structure.
Lars and I don't have meal preppable lifestyles.
Yeah, we don't have meal preppable lifestyles. But, you know, in terms of a comedy movie, I mean, in terms of any movie, really, I think structure is important as like a framework to hang shit on, to borrow a term or a phrase used by Red Letter Media a lot. But I care way more about gags. I care way more about laughing, which is interesting because this movie is not a gag-filled ride. But I also don't think the two are mutually exclusive. And I think that a film, even one that is gags constantly, still needs to have a good structure. Otherwise, it'll fall. Because if you watch a movie that is nothing but gags with no structure, then you're watching a date movie, a disaster movie, epic movie. That's what those are. You know,
or
that's
something
like
absurdist.
Every single character.
Yeah.
Especially, so for this, every single character is used for a comedic reason. You know, there's nobody that delivers a line in this movie that does not have some comedy bit to their character. Or the line itself is funny. And, you know, I think you could apply that same philosophy to a drama. But yeah. Use every single character. The shopkeeper is not just the shopkeeper. Mm-hmm. And he shouldn't just be a guy selling beans.
And I, piggybacking off of that, I just think, trust your actors. I think people directing comedies probably do that more than people directing dramas, unless you're like a Wes Anderson type who like...
Yeah, he's got his
troop. Has that meticulous thing, but I would imagine... It's not like David Wayne went up to Jane Lynch and said, okay, this is how I want you to do this, because you see this similar type of energy from Jane Lynch and all of her other movies, where I would imagine, you know, he was just like, okay, just go for it. I'm sure he was very much in, I'm sure a lot of it was improv'd, especially seeing that like four, David Wayne as well as three of the principal actors wrote the movie.
Yeah, I mean, that's the reason I think it's super improv. I think the structure was written out.
We didn't talk about Ken Marino, who was great in this.
Ken Marino was great, yeah.
Yeah, as far as the structure go, like, it definitely felt like there was a loose structure with a lot of improv. But, like, I trust actors.
Yeah.
Trust the actors.
What would you take away
Definitely to not be afraid to let your character archetypes write the story for you. Like, I think as long as you have a very unique environment in which you can put those archetypes in, that will pretty much write this, like, or kind of create these new ideas of how you can, you know, make these characters refreshing for the audience. Like, the whole LARPing thing, that's, you know, that's not something I expected for a character that's, you know, very cynical and not very cooperative. Mm-hmm. And then, like, kind of putting them in that space where they're really out of their element and they have to, you know, adopt this new identity, I thought was very, very interesting. So I think for me, it's just, if you have a character archetype, or if you have a character that you're realizing is falling under a certain category of an archetype, don't be afraid to put them in an environment where you know that you can come up with a very creative story.
Word.
Okay. Who do you guys recommend this movie to?
General audience, you know, anybody who likes a comedy movie, I think, can probably get something out of this, you know. Okay. I don't think anyone older than like 50 would probably enjoy it. You know, there's a little bit too much fuck word. There's a little bit of boobies. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I can't really see anybody that wouldn't enjoy it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean...
I think this is more of like a... For me, the setting in which we saw it, where it was the three of us, I thought that was who I would recommend it to. Like a group of, you know, just buddies.
Yeah, it's definitely not a movie that I'd recommend watching alone, but wouldn't recommend watching comedy films alone, generally.
You two definitely enjoy this movie a lot more than I do. So for me, and I think that it's apparent who I'm going to recommend this to. High school boys. This seems like the kind of movie
that I would watch. Are you calling us high school boys?
No, I'm saying...
inaccurate.
No, well, okay, yeah. I'm saying that, like, you probably love this because that's when you saw it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, yes. on one hand, like, the... Not... yeah, this is the kind of movie that I think I don't know what situation you guys watched this in. This is the kind of movie that I'm surprised I never watched.
I watched it in Max Tort's basement for the first time.
Like, sleeping over, like, at 1 in the morning? Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, that's when I watched The Hangover. That's when I watched Superbad. Like,
First time I watched The Hangover is the hardest I've ever laughed in my life.
Possibly me as well. Except for maybe the first time I ever watched Black Dynamite. Freshman year in Steve's... Because you know that's Steve Spurt's favorite movie too, right? Or like favorite comedy?
Yeah.
Like there are... The list of movies above this, if I just want to rewatch a movie that I know I'm going to laugh, is really high. But I think that for you guys, a lot of it is the nostalgia factor. And that's great. I don't get the benefit of the nostalgia factor for this movie. So
But you still enjoyed it.
Oh, I enjoyed watching it.
Yeah.
I enjoyed watching it for the purpose of this. I don't think it's ever going to be a movie that I would say, oh, we should watch this. But like Waiting, which I think I watched around the same age as you guys probably would have watched Role Models for the first time. You know, I was like, oh, we should watch Waiting. And then for me personally, I was like, it's not here. So like, I think the nostalgia factor is part of why we would want to rewatch a movie like this.
Yeah.
I'm glad that we didn't
have the Waiting problem. I'm glad that we watched it and, you know, it went over well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I had fun watching
it. Part of the reason I chose it was because I partially wanted it to not be good. We've liked everything we've seen so far, you know, just for variety's sake. Yeah. I was kind of hoping that we wouldn't like it, but then I still like it.
Do you know where this movie could be found? Like, if it's on any streaming services or anything?
I believe it is available on X Videos.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Sort of like, aren't there movies that are available on Pornhub?
You can watch all of B-Movie on Pornhub.
You can watch all of the last World Cup on Pornhub.
That's so weird.
That's what's happening.
You have
been hearing things, and you've been thinking for at least an hour. What are you thinking and hearing? What do you want to visually and auditorily ingest?
I don't know if either of you have seen this yet. I feel like I passed up on it, but I also know it's a gag-heavy movie, and I also, for some reason, I was not going to go see it, but I've heard that in the past couple months, people saying, oh, people really missed. Anyway, I want to watch The Lonely Island's Pop Star Never Stop Stopping.
I've never seen it.
Ooh, it's the first one nobody's seen.
Okay, wow. Good. Okay, good stuff. Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, this is great.
We'll
yeah,
have to no, use I remember my it, HBO Go. I think it's on HBO.
Is it?
Yeah.
I remember missing out on it in theaters. I think I was at a time in my life where I was like,
Over the Lonely
thought
Island?
Thought I was over I the Lonely Island.
Yeah.
Well, but then, I don't know. I've been, there are certain things where I'm like, oh, why do I think I'm over this?
Yeah,
I
recently Hot Rod watched, is fantastic.
Hot Rod is
And that's amazing. The Lonely Island. That's,
yeah, that is The Lonely
directed
Island.
Directed by Akiva.
And then I recently watched their Netflix special, The Unauthorized History of the Bash Brothers, with John and Jamie and Sugar Shane. And
Sugar
we
Shane.
Had a, we had a Have good time watching
Hell it. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you went frothing
Hell
with Sugar.
Yeah.
We're going to watch Pop Star Never Stop Stopping. Have some.
Is that really what it's called?
I believe it's called Never Stop. Or is it Never Stop Not Stopping? Let's look that up.
Pop Star Never Stop Stopping.
Yeah, it's Pop Star Never Stop Never Stopping.
All right. Well,
I'm excited about it.
I am too. Yeah, I like Andy Samberg.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's great. All right, well, goodbye.
15 Hail Marys.